All right, so the title of my message today is this: Is God a misogynist? Is God a misogynist? And by the way, a misogynist is basically someone who strongly dislikes women, if you have never heard that word before. Many feminists and atheists argue that the God of the Bible is portrayed as a misogynist. It is said that the Bible regards women as the mere property and of lesser value than men. The feminist author Karen Garst argues that religions like Christianity are, quote, the last cultural barrier to gender equality, and that biblical Christianity has historically participated in, quote, the subjugation and degradation of women. She further goes on to say that the Bible is, quote, not sacred or the inspired word of a deity because it was written by men who believed women were their property. So that's from the feminist author Karen Garst. She runs the blog The Faithless Feminist. She wrote the book Women vs. Religion. Another feminist writer by the name of Taslima Nasreen writes, quote, if one believes in women's rights, one first has to cast away one's religious identity. All religions are anti-women. No one can be pro-woman while supporting anti-woman dogmas. And of course, by anti-woman dogmas, she's talking about the values of Christianity as outlined in the Bible. So, the modern cultural narrative among feminist critics of biblical Christianity is that it is directly opposed to women. Now, this narrative is false, of course, as we'll learn. But before we get there, I want to highlight the importance of this issue. Unless you've been living under a rock for the past couple of years, you've noticed that we're kind of in the middle of a social revolution right now, aren't we? A couple of years ago, a famous film producer by the name of Harvey Weinstein was exposed as a serial sexual abuser. Over 80 women, 80, have made allegations against him, including allegations of rape. These allegations sparked what has come to be called the Me Too movement, which has since been shining a bright light on how women are mistreated and abused by powerful men. Okay, so there are a couple observations that we can make in light of all that is happening here. Number one, despite all of our social progress in the West, women are still being abused, exploited, and degraded by men. Despite all of our social progress in the West, women are still being abused, exploited, and degraded by men. And this is taking place in places even like Hollywood, which is supposedly run by the most enlightened and progressive among us, folks who have ditched archaic worldviews like Christianity and have fully embraced modern feminism. And yet, despite all of feminism's social advancements, despite the progressive movement, women are still treated as objects, even in those places. They are still exploited and abused. Dr. Katie McCoy puts it very well. This is what she says, quote, we women can vote, own businesses, pursue any educational or vocational field, be CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, university presidents, U.S. senators, but we still have to be careful going to the grocery store at night. We still have to walk fast with our eyes forward and pray that the catcalling men don't become aggressive. We still have to be hyper-vigilant in a parking garage. For all of the social activism of the last 60 years, rape culture, sexual harassment, and misogyny have not been educated out of society or reformed away. She further goes on to say, for all of our social progress, humanity's core still remains unchanged. And for all of our social advantages, women still face oppression and sexual abuse. That women have achieved unparalleled independence, yet still contend for basic safety and public value, is a sobering cultural commentary. End quote. So what does this tell us? It tells us that the problem in our society cannot be solved by more of the same. The feminist movement has therefore been utterly ineffective in helping women and bringing about true change. Women are still oppressed they're still mistreated, there's still sexual assault. The reason we are dealing with all of these issues still in this society, this progressive society of ours, is that we are dealing with a moral problem. The reason is that we are dealing with a moral problem. And this leads to a second observation that I want to make. Number two, our society is hungry. It's aching. It's crying out for justice and moral revolution. Our society is hungry for justice and moral revolution. Female oppression is a moral problem, right? The claim that men shouldn't abuse women is a moral claim. Demanding that men, quote unquote, do better, as the Me Too movement demands, that is a moral demand. Even the idea that women ought to be valued and protected from abuse, that is a moral value. But these moral values assume something, don't they? These moral values assume an objective moral standard. Otherwise, you can't have these moral values. If there is no God, there is no objective moral standard. Think about it this way. If atheism is true, on what basis do women or men have any objective moral worth at all? We're merely the accidental byproduct of chance, no different than any other living organism on the speck of dirt we call Earth. We're all doomed to die in the eventual heat death of the universe trillions of years from now. Human life will be utterly inconsequential in the grand scheme of things. We've all evolved from primordial goo, just the same as mosquitoes and rats. If atheism is true, why should we treat human beings as special? Where do we get these delusions that we have these moral obligations toward one another, that people have intrinsic dignity and they're worthy of respect? After all, on the atheistic view, humans are just animals, and animals have no moral responsibility. We don't sentence a hyena to prison for murder when it kills a wildebeest, right? That would be ridiculous. We don't condemn male dolphins as rapists when they forcibly copulate with female dolphins. Why? Because they're just being animals. So if humans are just animals too, then on what basis can we truly say that men should, quote unquote, do better? On what basis can we truly say that women should be protected? Without God, we have no objective basis for saying that Harvey Weinstein, Jeffrey Epstein, and all the rest are really morally wrong. We can't say it. We can disagree with it, but we have no moral basis to say that it really is morally wrong. In fact, it gets even worse. If God doesn't exist, if life came about only by natural causes, whereby the strong overpowers the weak, survival of the fittest, how can we even say that crimes like rape are morally wrong? We can't. There was a paper written in 2002 by two evolutionary sociobiologists, Randy Thornhill and Craig Palmer, and the title of their paper was Why Men Rape. In this paper, they conclude that rape has a quote-unquote evolutionary basis. It's not about control or domination, they say, but a sexual impulse within men that has evolved. Rape has evolved as a reproductive strategy, quote unquote. Men who were unable to get a woman any other way would just take them by force. But if the impulse to sexually overpower women is the result of evolution, as they say, then within the naturalistic, atheistic worldview, it is not only morally neutral, it is necessary for human survival. Naturalism, therefore, gives humans no intrinsic value. Again, we're all just animals. The naturalistic, atheistic worldview gives us no imperative to protect the vulnerable in society. It gives us no imperative to do better. So what is the secular solution to this problem? Because we all agree it's a problem. Even the atheist and the secularist agrees that this is a problem. They have no logical or objective basis for that moral judgment, but still, we all agree it's a problem. Well, in their paper, Thornhill and Palmer, they don't explain why, according to their worldview, behavior such as rape is wrong. And they don't explain how concepts like right and wrong can even exist to begin with, according to their worldview. However, they nevertheless propose a solution, and that is an education program for young boys, informing them of their evolved sexual desires. This is what they write. Quote, most of all, the program should stress that a man's evolved sexual desires offer him no excuse whatsoever for raping a woman, and that if he understands and resists those desires, he may be able to prevent their manifestation in sexually coercive behavior. End quote. He may be able to prevent its manifestation if he understands his evolved sexual desires. In other words, if men understand why their brains evolved to be what they are, they might be able to stop themselves from raping. In other words, you are an animal. And if you understand that you're an animal, maybe you'll learn to live not like an animal or something. That's the solution. Inform men that they are a slave to nature. And if they know that, maybe they'll be able to control themselves. Dr. Katie McCoy does a great job of just ripping this to shreds and exposing the logical flaws in this kind of thinking. Here's what she says, quote, even this suggestion implies a moral code that is incongruent with purely biological explanations for such sexually corrosive behavior. If sexual assault is an adaptation, upon what moral basis would a man attempt to, quote, prevent its manifestation? Upon what moral basis would a government even penalize a man for such a crime? After all, maybe his brain made him do it. This is the logical conclusion of the naturalistic, atheistic worldview. There is no objective basis for female dignity. There is no objective basis for moral behavior. Without God, all we're left with is naturalism. And as we've seen, naturalism gives us no real solutions. Secular feminism doesn't work. It hasn't worked. It has failed. It cannot bring about true change in society whereby women are valued and protected. So we've talked about what doesn't work. What does work? How do we solve this problem? How do we change the world and elevate the status of women? The answer is biblical Christianity. We know that Christianity changes the world because it already has changed the world, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. What I'd like to do now, though, is establish a broad biblical framework on this issue. I'm just going to throw out a ton of information. I'm going to go kind of fast, but hopefully we'll get through this and we'll have time to zero in on some of the difficult passages which appear on the surface to denigrate women. But before we do that, because what I want to do is I want to explain those passages in context and see how they don't denigrate women. So that's my goal. But before we do that, it's important that we establish God's overall perspective as revealed in Scripture. The overall message of the Bible clearly affirms the immense value and personhood of women, which, by the way, is equal to that of men. The Bible affirms the immense value and personhood of women, which is equal to that of men. This perspective is clearly evident in the very beginning of the biblical story. Genesis 1:27 says, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Genesis 1, beginning of creation. Here we see that God created both men and women in his image. Both men and women in his image. Being created in God's image, by the way, not only bestows upon humans intrinsic value, but it also elects them to represent God's purposes and will on earth. So that is to say, both men and women are equal in dignity and vocation in God's creation and plan. They're equal in dignity and purpose in God's creation and plan. So here we already have a major difference between atheism and Christianity. Human moral worth makes sense only within a theistic worldview. It doesn't make sense on atheism. Concerning Genesis 1, Dr. Richard Davidson writes this. He says, "The fundamental equality of men and women is unhesitatingly proclaimed in the first chapter of the Bible." So feminism doesn't get to steal the credit for the concept that women have equal value to men. They don't get to steal the credit. The Bible came up with that concept first. But this raises a question. If the Bible was hopelessly misogynistic, as feminists claim, why do women share the special status of bearing God's image along with men? Scripture teaches that women, just like men, have intrinsic value and purpose. Women even share with men the blessing of dominion over all creation. So when we look at, furthermore, the creation of woman, specifically Eve, we read that she was taken from Adam's side. It's usually translated rib in Hebrew. It literally means side. And thus Eve is represented as Adam's other half, if you will. It's teaching us that man is incomplete without woman. It's not good that man should be alone, right? Man needed a partner to fulfill the divine calling of bearing God's image and ruling over creation. Men and women are different, and therefore they need each other to fulfill God's purposes. When we look at the establishment of marriage, we see that man is to leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife. This teaches us that a man's first loyalty is not to his parents, it's not to his tribe, it's not to the government. His first loyalty is to his wife. He holds fast to her, it says, which is a phrase that is often used to express the covenant commitment that one is to have toward God. Marriage is a bond wherein the wife is honored, she's cherished, and she's protected. And sex is to be enjoyed only within those safe boundaries of a loving covenant relationship between man and wife. It's not supposed to be taken from a woman outside of those boundaries. It's only to be enjoyed within those loving boundaries where she feels cherished, protected, and loved. Therefore, according to the first two chapters of Genesis, women aren't inferior beings or property that are created to be used and abused by men. No, they have intrinsic worth and are equal partners with men in the divine purpose to glorify God on earth. They have intrinsic worth, and they are equal partners with men in the divine purpose to glorify God on earth. Now, this is Genesis 1 through 2. But even beyond Genesis 1 through 2, as Paul Copen writes, there are, quote, undeniable affirmations of equality in the Old Testament from theological, historical, and legal perspectives, end quote. In the midst of this fallen world, and in the midst of man-made societal structures, God condescended to meet humans where they were, and he gave them the Torah, he gave them his law, and he gently directed them back toward the creation ideal as much as possible, that creation ideal established in the first two chapters of Genesis. There are hints of this creation ideal embedded all over the Torah. For example, consider the fifth commandment. Exodus 22, honor your father and your mother. Honor your father and your mother. Now, many of us who've grown up in the church, we've heard this passage so many times that we tend to gloss over it. But really think about that for a second. Mother, or father and mother are equally worthy of honor within the family. The same punishment applies for when you strike your father as when you strike your mother. By the way, this is in stark contrast to the values of other cultures in the ancient Near East. In other ancient Near Eastern law codes and other ancient Near Eastern literature, we see that the mother was often controlled by the son, her son in the family. So the Bible reverses this, and the Bible establishes equality within the family between father and mother. In addition, the Torah expresses the equality of men and women in regard to morality, purity, and justice. As Paul Copin observes, he says, quote, "The moral and ceremonial laws of Israel presumed that women were not only equal, but also shared equal moral responsibility with the men." So they had equal moral responsibility to serve God alongside men. Deuteronomy 29 teaches that women, along with men, are full members of God's covenant community. Deuteronomy 31 teaches that women, along with men, are fully accountable to God and expected to learn and do His commandments. Women also receive the same benefits as men in the Torah. Sabbath rest, for example, being able to participate in worship services at the tabernacle and temple services. Now, when you get to the New Testament, this creation ideal of male-female equality and dignity is again fully reaffirmed. Galatians 3 teaches that men and women stand equal before the Father in regard to being justified and included among His people. In contrast to the low view of women that's expressed in the Greco-Roman culture that was surrounding the early church, followers of Messiah promoted equality and protection for women. And guess how they did this? Guess how the early church promoted equality and protection for women in the first century? They did this primarily by adhering to a biblical sexual ethic. A biblical sexual ethic. In the Greco-Roman world, women were truly second-class citizens. According to Nancy Piercy, married men often engaged in extramarital affairs with, quote, girlfriends, mistresses, prostitutes, courtesans, other men, and most of all, household slaves. So this forced men's wives to have to, quote, compete with a host of other people for their husbands' love and affection. In opposition to this cultural double standard where men virtually had no limits on their sexual conduct, Paul taught that infidelity on the part of the husband is no less severe a sin than infidelity on the part of the wife, demonstrating once again the creation ideal of equality. According to 1 Corinthians 7, a husband not only has authority over his wife's body, but a wife has authority over her husband's body. So again, Christianity's sexual ethic, in addition to its opposition to practices of abortion and infanticide, which were very prevalent in that culture, Christianity's opposition to those things, in addition to its sexual values, were among the main reasons women in the ancient world were so drawn to the early church. In fact, one of the earliest criticisms of Christianity, because it was so popular among women, was that it was a, quote, woman's religion. That was how early pagans would criticize Christianity, as a woman's religion, because it was so popular. Ironically, the very values that liberated and elevated women in the ancient world are the same values that modern feminists despise and view as oppressive. The very values that liberated and elevated women in the ancient world are the same values that modern feminists despise and view as oppressive. The truth is that feminist ideals, such as abortion on demand, casual sex without commitment, those are harmful. Those are what degrade women. Those are what abuse and mistreat women, those values. It goes, the feminist, modern feminist is, goes right back to those, to that second class citizenship, if you will, in the Greco-Roman world. In summary, as we've seen, an overall picture of the treatment of women in the Bible reveals that they have immense value and are worthy of honor and protection. Now, there is a lot more that I can say on that point, and I'm actually in the process of writing a book on this, and you'd just be amazed at how much there is. But I do want to focus a little bit now on some of the difficult passages and see if we can get some clarity. And if we have time after that, maybe I can answer a few questions if you all have any. But the first topic that we'll bring up is polygamy. Polygamy. So it's no secret that many men in the Bible, Many prominent men, King David, Jacob, they engaged in this practice of polygamy. The Torah even has regulations concerning polygamous marriages. There's laws on what to do when you're in a polygamous marriage. Here's how inheritances are to be handled and things like that. This has led some to conclude that the Bible permits or even endorses this practice, and understandably, this is a big problem with women. Most women are not cool with sharing their husband with another lady, and it's understandable. Many feminist critics point to the Bible's alleged endorsement of polygamy as proof that the Bible views women as property, male property. So, where do we begin in answering this issue? Well, I have 4 points that I want to make here really quick. Unfortunately, because of time, we won't really be able to unpack everything as much as I'd like. Like I said, I have a book that I'm writing. There's an entire chapter dedicated to this topic. If you want some scholarly resources, I recommend Dr. Richard Davidson's book, Flame of Yahweh, and also Dr. Gordon Hugenberger's book, Marriage as Covenant. 119 Ministries are actually coming out with a teaching soon on this topic of polygamy as well. But here are 4 points that I want to make really quick on this topic. This is my argument. I do not believe, by the way, I'll state that up front, I do not believe that the Bible endorses this practice. Number one, like homosexuality, polygamy is a clear deviation from God's original design for marriage as established in creation. So it goes against the creation ideal. Number two, the Torah does, in fact, prohibit the practice of polygamy. Number three, rather than being endorsed in the Bible, polygamy is consistently painted in a negative light and therefore discouraged, as I'll argue. And number four, the passages used to say that polygamy is approved by God are misunderstood. So let's dive in. Regarding this first point, that like homosexuality, polygamy is a clear deviation from God's original plan for marriage. Regarding this first point, it's pretty self-evident, right? You just read Genesis 1 and 2. Monogamy is God's original design for marriage. That's how he established it. But also, both Yeshua, Jesus, and Paul, they affirm monogamy by using the creation model as the basis for their own teachings on what marriage is supposed to look like. Now, while monogamy may not have been the focus of their teachings, it is nevertheless the assumed model in every mention of marriage throughout the New Testament. Every time marriage is taught on or talked about, it is assumed that monogamy is the model. 1 Corinthians 7:2 says, quote, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband. In 1 Timothy 3, Paul said that elders and deacons within the church are only to have one wife, which again reinforces monogamy for everyone, since elders are to be examples of righteous living to the rest of the church. A prohibition of polygamy can also be logically deduced from Yeshua's teaching in Matthew 19 when he teaches about divorce. Yeshua says that a man who divorces his wife without warrant and marries another, quote, commits adultery. As scholar Philip Siegel explains, Yeshua, quote, would not call a divorced man's remarriage adultery if he was permitted a second wife. Think about it. He would not call a divorced man's remarriage adultery if he was permitted a second wife. Therefore, if the original marriage was typological, the original marriage in creation in Genesis, if that original marriage was typological for all marriages as Yeshua and Paul understood it, then polygamy obviously goes against God's intent for marriage. But what about the second point? The second point that the Torah does prohibit polygamy, because you'll hear a lot of people say, well, if polygamy was such a big deal, if God was so against polygamy, why aren't there any commandments against it? Why aren't there any commandments in his law that forbid it if it is so bad? Well, consider this commandment from Leviticus 18:18. Leviticus 18:18 says, "You shall not marry a woman in addition to her sister as a rival while she is alive, to uncover her nakedness. You shall not marry a woman in addition to her sister as a rival while she is alive to uncover her nakedness. Now, this verse is usually understood as prohibiting only one type of polygamous marriage. The traditional interpretation is that this prohibits only a marriage to two sisters while both are alive, literal sisters. However, scholars have pointed out several reasons to think that this verse does not necessarily refer to two blood-related sisters, but actually to two women in general. And if that is correct, we therefore have a direct commandment forbidding polygamy in the Torah. By the way, we know this interpretation was held by some first century Jewish groups. The Qumran community has commentaries. If you read the Temple Scroll and the Dead Sea Scrolls, they actually appeal to Leviticus 18:18 in their own writings and interpret it as a general ban on polygamy. And they weren't the only ones, I would argue. I would argue that the apostles and Yeshua shared that same perspective. But why should we believe, why should we agree with some of these first century Jewish groups and these scholars that I mentioned, why should we believe that Leviticus 18:18 prohibits all polygamy rather than simply prohibiting a marriage between a man and literal sisters? Well, first, in Hebrew, a woman in addition to her sister, in the verse, is Isha el Achota, which literally means a woman to her sister. Scholars have pointed out that this is an idiomatic expression that is always used in the distributive sense of one in addition to another. We're going to get a little bit technical, but it's an idiomatic expression that is always used throughout the Old Testament in the distributive sense of one in addition to another. Exodus 26 speaks of the coupling of curtains and clasps, quote, one to another, which is literally a woman to her sister. Ezekiel 1 speaks of the wings of the cherubim touching, quote, one another, which is literally a woman to her sister. In Hebrew, this is Isha el Achota, the exact same phrase that is used in Leviticus 18:18. In fact, every time the phrase Isha el Achota occurs in the Tanakh, in the Old Testament, it is used in an idiomatic manner, meaning, quote, one to another. By the way, this is also used with the masculine equivalent of the phrase, which is used also a bunch of times in the Old Testament, Ish el Achu, which literally means a man to his brother. Every single time that phrase is used, it's used in an idiomatic manner, meaning one in addition to another. Therefore, when we interpret this phrase in light of its consistent usage all throughout the Bible, Leviticus 18:18 ought to be understood as saying, quote, you shall not marry one woman in addition to another. Now, there are several additional arguments. That's not the only one. There's about six more. Six other grammatical and exegetical evidences for this interpretation. And if you're interested, you can check out an article I wrote on this topic. It's on my website. I'll also be covering it in my book that I mentioned. And I wish we could go through it all more, but believe me, there's much more to it that would further substantiate that interpretation, that this is actually a law forbidding polygamy in general. But we simply don't have time, so let's move on quickly to my third point, and that is that polygamy is consistently painted in a negative light and therefore discouraged rather than encouraged. So, in addition to these specific moral and legal statements within the Torah, and also within the apostolic writings with Paul and Yeshua in Matthew 19, the biblical authors teach against polygamy through narrative clues, which reveal the disastrous consequences of the practice. This is what Dr. Richard Davidson writes. He says, quote, in the patriarchal period, there are several biblical examples of plural marriages. Although these biblical narratives provide no explicit verbal condemnation of this practice, the narrator presents each account in such a way as to underscore a theology of disapproval. The record of these polygamous relationships bristles with discord, rivalry, heartache, and even rebellion, revealing the motivations and/or disastrous consequences that invariably accompanied such departures from God's Edenic ideal. So the narrator presents each account, according to Davidson, in such a way as to underscore a theology of disapproval. It's pretty self-evident. We have Abraham and the disaster that was with Sarah and Hagar. We have Jacob and the disaster that was. And of course, we have King Solomon. In 1 Kings 11, the biblical author is clear that Solomon's idolatry and the eventual downfall of him were the direct result of his polygamy. You can't get any clearer than that. The negative consequences of polygamy throughout Israel's history, by the way, is probably a big reason the Jews all but abandoned the practice by the first century. David N. Stone Brewer writes that polygamy, quote, was not widespread and it was already declining in the first century. He goes on to say that, quote, there was already an established feeling that polygamy was inappropriate. And we know that. The Qumran community literally have writings interpreting Leviticus 18:18 as a ban on polygamy in general. And they were very clear that they thought polygamy was immoral. And I would argue that the apostles and Yeshua felt the same way, according to what we looked at in their writings. All right, so the fourth point, really quick, is that the passages that allegedly approve of polygamy have been misunderstood. I won't go through all of these passages, but I will address a couple. And the first one is in Deuteronomy 21, 15 through 17. And this is a law in the Torah which details inheritance rights within a polygamous family. And so it's argued that, well, there are laws governing polygamous marriages. So how can God be against it if he gave laws governing polygamous marriages? Well, this is actually really easy to deal with when you think about it. First, it's a mistake to assume that the existence of laws that address negative situations prove that God approves of the situation. Let me say that again. It's a mistake to assume that the existence of laws addressing negative situations prove that God approves of the situation. There are laws, for example, for restitution. If someone steals from someone else, there are laws on what to do when that happens. But those laws don't legitimize theft. Deuteronomy 23:18 forbids prostitute wages from being used as payment of vows. But the existence of this law doesn't legitimize prostitution. It just says if you've made wages through prostitution, don't use the money for payment of vows. In the same way, the existence of laws detailing the rights of the firstborn in a less than ideal situation, that is a polygamous family, it doesn't legitimize polygamy. So this law does not legitimize polygamy. It's just giving us instruction on what to do in that negative situation. Okay, well, what about 2 Samuel 12? In this passage, God declares through Nathan that he, quote unquote, gave Saul's wives to David. Now people will say, see, how can God be against polygamy if he gave David multiple wives himself? It says he gave him the wives. He would have given him more, it even goes on to say, if he wasn't satisfied. Well, first, why do we assume that God's giving of Saul's wives to David entails that David married them? That's a complete baseless assumption. All this passage is saying is that Saul's entire estate, it mentions other things besides his wives, his entire estate has been transferred to David's care. That's all it's saying. Nothing in the text indicates marriage at all. In fact, it can't be that he married them. Because David couldn't have married Saul's wives since he'd be violating God's laws against incest. One of Saul's wives was the mother of David's wife, Michal. So if we're going to go with the logic that in this passage, God's giving of Saul's wives to David, assuming that he married them again, which there's no evidence of, but if we assume that, if that therefore legitimizes polygamy, then we'd have to say the same thing about incest, since one of Saul's wives was David's mother-in-law. Obviously, that doesn't work. Much more can be said. Obviously, there are other passages that we can go through. But hopefully, with that, we can see that contrary to the complaints of feminists and critics, the Bible in no way endorses polygamy. All right, there's one other objection that I want to address really quickly. It's a difficult one. And one common complaint that you'll hear from feminists is that the Bible commands rape victims to marry their rapists. You'll often hear that the Bible sanctions rape, according to some passages in Deuteronomy 22. And if that were true, that would be pretty disturbing. And I would have a problem with that, as I would hope we all would. You know, I mean, what do you do with that? If the Bible sanctions rape, that how do you deal with that? Well, I don't think it does. This objection is based on Deuteronomy 22, verses 28 through 29, which says that if a man, quote unquote, seizes a young virgin and has sex with her, he is to pay her father 50 shekels of silver and marry her. So feminists will rage and complain. They'll say, oh, this passage is clear proof that the Bible regards women as simply the property of men. According to critics, the female victim in this passage is sold to her violator, the person who raped her and violently attacked her and degraded her. He's sold to her by her father. How do we address this? Well, there are several nuances that are worth pointing out in this text that paint a different picture. First, this passage is preceded by legislation that clearly does address rape. So the Bible does address rape directly before this. According to verses 25 through 27, if a man seizes, quote unquote, which is the word chazak, if he seizes a woman in an open field, the Torah demands he be put to death. That's what the Bible says. But the young woman is presumed innocent in this case. This passage, where it describes rape as a violent act, worthy of the death penalty, it uses a different Hebrew word for seizes that's translated seizes in English. It's a different word that is used in verse 28. The verb here, according to Dr. Katie McCoy, can refer, quote, to the violent overpowering of another, and in the context of this text, clearly denotes rape. So in verses 25 through 27, it clearly denotes rape. What do we learn from that? We learn that the Bible regards rape as a horrific and violent act. In fact, it's directly compared to murder. Deuteronomy 22:26 says, quote, for this case is like that of a man attacking and murdering his neighbor. The woman in this scenario is portrayed as a victim worthy of justice, not as the property of a man. By the way, this is unlike other ancient law codes, such as the Middle Assyrian laws, which actually did sanction sexual assault, and they actually permitted retaliatory rape upon an assailant's wife. So if someone raped someone else, if he was married, the Middle Assyrian law said, you must take the rapist's wife, and she must be raped. So, you know, that's already we see a big difference between what the Bible says. The Torah upholds the value and personhood and safety of women. Again, if a woman is raped, her rapist is put to death, and she is considered a victim who is worthy of justice, not as property. So what do we do with the passage directly after that? Well, when we get to verses 28 through 29, they seem to be describing a different type of situation than that which was just described in verses 25 through 27. Think about it. Does it really make logical sense that one rapist gets the death penalty, but then right after that, it says that the woman must marry her rapist? There's something else going on here. There's something more here. While verses 25 through 27 do speak of rape, verses 28 through 29 speak of a young couple's consensual sexual encounter. That's what I propose. Verses 28 through 29 speak of a young couple's consensual sexual encounter. There's several points that I want to make to establish this. First, as I already mentioned, a different word is used for seizes. That word is tafas. Okay? While this word does mean to capture or to seize, unlike chazak, which is used previously in the context of rape, it does not carry the same connotation of force. So if the biblical author intended to describe rape in verses 28 through 29, it's reasonable to think that he would use chazak, as he does in the verses 25 through 27. But he doesn't. He uses a completely different word. In addition to not having the same connotation of force, tafas is also used in nonviolent metaphors to speak of things like God, quote unquote, capturing or seizing the heart of Israel. So it's a metaphor talking about capturing the heart of Israel, okay, and other places like that as well. This has led some scholars to interpret the use of tafas in this passage to imply that the man, quote unquote, seizes the woman not in a physical sense, but in an emotional sense. He captures her heart. Now, this point is especially relevant when we consider this legislation in light of the parallel passage in Exodus 22. Starting in verse 16, it says, "If a man seduces a virgin," did you catch that? "If a man seduces a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall give the bride price for her and make her his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the bride price for virgins." All right, so Deuteronomy 22, 28 through 29, it elaborates on this legislation in Exodus that we just read. Remarkably, in Exodus, rather than the word seizes, the Exodus passage uses the verb patah, which means seduces. So based on this parallel legislation, it's likely that this section in Deuteronomy is not dealing with rape, but with seduction. In this scenario, the man persuades the young woman to engage in sex and she consents. This is what Paul Copen writes. He says, "Even if there is some pressure from the man, the young woman is complicit. Though initially pressured, seduced, she doesn't act against her will." All right, now, to be clear, I'm not suggesting that the woman in this scenario wasn't mistreated. She certainly was mistreated. Although she wasn't raped, she consented to sex, the man still dishonored her by persuading her to engage in sex without first giving her the dignity of marriage. So therefore, this is what the Torah does. It holds the man accountable for his behavior by requiring that he make things right, by requiring that he marry her. Also, as you learned in the parallel passage from Exodus, the father has the right to refuse. So the woman wasn't required to marry the man. So it's an unsympathetic misrepresentation to say that women were required to marry their rapists. No, she wasn't required. There was a right to refuse. In either case, the Bible doesn't force rape victims to marry their victims. Or to marry their rapists. We're almost done. I just want to add to that. In verses 25 through 27, the Bible depicts rape as a horrific and violent act, which is comparable to murder, and it's worthy of the capital punishment. It's worthy of death. Female victims of rape are to be protected and cared for, according to the Torah. When it comes to verses 28 through 29, the law for the couple to get married is designed ultimately for the protection and security of the woman, in addition to holding men accountable. Therefore, far from degrading women or abusing women, this legislation upholds the dignity and personhood of women. Men weren't allowed to just use and lose a woman. They weren't allowed to use them and abuse them. Sex is only to be enjoyed within the boundaries of that covenant commitment, that covenant marriage, where the woman feels honored, protected, and cherished. And if it happens outside of that, not by rape, but by a consensual sexual encounter, fornication outside of that, the man is to be held accountable. He's to make things right. He's to give her the dignity of marriage. So when we take a closer look at these passages, we clearly see that God has a deep concern for the protection of women. And far from reflecting the character of some misogynistic deity who views women as inferior to men or as property, God's laws demonstrate his love and concern for women over and over and over again. The scriptures affirm that women are worthy of honor, dignity, and protection. So, in conclusion, the Bible teaches us that women are valuable and should be protected. Christianity gives us a basis for the demand that men should, quote unquote, do better. Men have a responsibility to care and protect the vulnerable in society. And as for the sickness within our culture that degrades women, Christianity is not the problem. It's the solution to the problem. Only the Messiah and his presence within the ministry of the congregation can bring about true change and justice to this world. Thank you.
It is because of you, our generous supporters, who make it possible to offer these high-quality teachings completely free of charge. If you feel led to support 119 Ministries so that we can continue this effort, please visit testeverything.net and click on the Support 119 tab. Learn how you can partner with us to take the whole Word of God to the nations.